thank you all for coming out tonight. This is our first of what will be a series of speaker events that the University of Chicago's Project on Security and Terrorism is putting together. You'll see that over the course of this term, of this year and next year, about every 2 or 3 months, we're going to try to bring you ideas that really matter, that are engaging the world in a serious way. And Bob's ideas are surely that. I do want to thank iHouse. We couldn't do this without their strong support. I also want to thank the Social Science Division and the Dean's Office at the University of Chicago, which has been very much behind CPOST. And I also want to send a special thanks to the undergraduates here who have worked. There's a special group. We're forming an SRO. It will be coming soon in just weeks that is called UPOST. It's sort of the undergraduate version of CPOST. And many of them have worked hard to put this event together. If you want to know more about CPOST and UPOST, there's a flyer in the back. You can just pick it up on your way out. Well, I can't think of a better person to kick us off than Robert Kagan. He, for over a decade, has been one of the leading voices on American foreign policy in Washington. As you'll quickly see, Bob is a learned man with a formidable intellect and a host of impeccable credentials. A graduate of Yale, he earned his master's and PhD at Harvard and American University, respectively. He first gained world attention when he published on a book called Of Paradise and Power in 2003, which powerfully argued that Americans and Europeans have fundamentally different approaches to foreign policy. This book stayed on the New York Times bestseller list for 10 weeks and put him in the forefront of influential policy thinkers in Washington. He's published numerous books and articles since, including more bestsellers, and he's now a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings, one of the most prominent pedestals in Washington. He is perhaps best known for his strong views on why the United States is indispensable for maintaining and spreading today's liberal international order. Robert's views are particularly important today because if you just Google the New York Times, you'll see story after story about the increasingly close relationship between Bob and Hillary Clinton, which he's going to deny. I understand that. But the ideas are what matter. And over the last 10 years, Hillary Clinton's ideas have increasingly approached Bob's, not the other way around. So I'm sure that Hillary Clinton knows his ideas, and he may want to talk about some of the ways in which that has happened. But his ideas are becoming a pillar in Washington, and whether you agree with them or not, they're important to engage. You'll also see that Bob is a gentleman. Bob and I don't always see eye to eye. In fact, we have debated each other numerous times, and we often don't see eye to eye. But we can discuss things respectfully, and I always learn something from Bob. And without any further ado, I would like Bob to come up. He's going to speak for about 15 or 20 minutes. Then we'll have a conversation for about another 15 or so minutes. And then after that, we'll turn it over. We have a microphone for people to come up. When you come up, whether you ask a question or try to make a statement as a question, it has to be brief. Okay? You all know that we want to hear different views, so you can disagree as well as agree or extend. But we really want to make sure that we're here to hear Bob, and so we want to make sure that happens. So please help me welcome Robert Kagan.
Well, thank you so much, Bob. I feel like I should spend at least a portion of that 15 minutes saving Hillary Clinton from what you've just done to her. But I won't do that. And let me say thank you for such a really wonderful and gracious introduction. And thank you for hosting this here at iHouse. And thank you all for being here. I hear tell that Americans don't care about foreign policy. So either that means that you're not Americans, or you're abnormal, or something. But in any case, I appreciate you're coming out in the cold to discuss foreign policy. I personally think it's a very important topic. So I'm glad to be here and looking forward to our conversation. In 20 minutes, there's only so much, 15 minutes, there's only so much that I can do. But in so far as we're in a building, I don't know, was the building is from 1932? Or yes, we're in a building. We're certainly in an organization that dates back to 1932. I hope you'll forgive me. My basic training is as a historian, and I wanted to talk a little bit about history because I think it's wrong. Sometimes, depending on who you are, you want to start thinking about American history at 9/11, or maybe the end of the Cold War, or maybe the Cold War, but I really think it's worth going quite a bit further back. I would go back to the beginning, but at the very least, when it comes to discussing a question like America, the indispensable nation, I do think you have to go at least back to World War I, and especially the conclusion of World War I. The United States was the indispensable nation in World War I. It was because the United States entered the war that the war ended the way it did. By the way, not because Americans won the key battles, although they certainly participated in them, but once Germany saw 2 million fresh soldiers coming across the ocean to join those who'd already been fighting them, they basically decided to throw in the towel. And the result of America's joining that conflict and defeating Germany was that what had been at least a stalemate, and probably a stalemate favoring Germany, turned into a defeat of Germany and in a completely different kind of balance on the European continent that at the end of the war favored Britain, France, the United States, which is to say the democratic victors in that war. And the Versailles Treaty that was written with all its flaws was a treaty that depended on the United States for its fulfillment. You know, I think in your history books, you go back and you read about all the failings of the Versailles Treaty. It was either too Carthaginian or it was too lax, take your pick. But it was never meant to operate without the United States. And I think that, I'll give you the short version here, but I think that once the United States pulled out of its commitments at Versailles, there was no way that treaty could possibly work. It wouldn't have mattered what Britain or France or Germany did. There was no way of restoring a balance on the continent. But Americans made a decision in 1919 and 1920. They were presented with the option of playing a central, if not the central, role in the world in maintaining a peace, primarily in Europe, but one could argue globally as well, and for a variety of reasons, they said no. Now, in my personal view, you may not be shocked to hear this, one of the major reasons that the League of Nations and the Covenant was defeated in Congress was for purely partisan reasons. I know that shocks you, because we know that America doesn't behave that way, but in any case, whatever the reason, it was a fact. And when Americans turned against the treaty, they also turned against the war. And they decided that the war itself had been a terrible mistake and something that they never wanted to do again. And in fairness, they lost 116,000 soldiers. We know how we've reacted to far fewer losses over a much longer period of time in Afghanistan and Iraq. You can imagine losing over 100,000 soldiers in a matter of months, really. And so there was tremendous disillusionment and a desire to turn away from any kind of real commitment to the world, to the point where when the League of Nations sent letters to the State Department would not open them, put them in a dead letter box. That was the degree of non-involvement that Americans wanted. And I have to say, in the 1920s, it seemed like a pretty safe decision. If you looked around the world in the 1920s, you could look over at Germany. It was Weimar Germany. It was a bit of a mess in many respects, but it was a cultural, you know, it was a major cultural center. All kinds of wonderful things were happening. It certainly didn't seem threatening. Japan was struggling with a new democratic form of government, also relatively peaceful, at that moment at least, under those governments. In fact, you could be pretty hard-pressed looking around the world to find a serious threat or even a serious plausible threat to American security or to world security writ large. And as we all know, it really wasn't much more than a decade later when whatever semblance of world order had been created after World War I not only crumbled, but crumbled into complete disaster. And I don't have to recount the events of the 1930s to remind you of how awful everything became after everything seemed so solved in the 1920s. And I say this because I'm often lately been accused of thinking that it's always the 1930s. As I look ahead at the future, I want to plead guilty only to always thinking it's the 1920s. Which is to say, the world order is a fragile place. It is amazing how quickly, a fragile thing, and it is amazing how quickly it can crumble into disorder and chaos. It is amazing how quickly the rules that you think have been established can be violated. It is amazing how quickly great powers can arise to wreak real havoc on an international system. And so, as I think about today and the structure of the international system that we have today, that international system was built by people who lived through the 1930s. In fact, the major planks of the international order that I talk about, the liberal international order, were envisioned and begun even to put into place during World War II, before the Soviet Union had even appeared as a threat, at a time, I think, when many, including Franklin Roosevelt and even Dean Acheson, thought the Soviets would be an ally, not only during the war, but after the war. No, the order was put into place in order to prevent what had just happened from ever happening again. That's what statesmen do. They always try to prevent what just happened from happening again. And in this case, it was the collapse of the world order. And what they had seen had happened was that the order had collapsed at least across three major planes. It had collapsed in an economic sense, when a relatively free trading system became closed off by autarkic economic policies, including by the United States, in fact, led by the United States in many ways, which had led to a breakdown of the free trading system and using economics more as warfare than as an opportunity. They'd seen the undermining of democracies. There were over two dozen democracies in the world after World War I. By the time of World War II, there were less than 10, and everybody had seen what had happened to democracy in that period. And make no mistake, at that time, they saw a connection between autocracy, or in that case, some cases, totalitarianism or fascism, and aggression. That was the common thread that they saw. And finally, of course, they'd seen the collapse of the security order. And so what they set out to do was to establish a new order in all these realms: the economic realm, a liberal economic order, an order that was basically protective, although not obviously consistently protective of democracy, and an underlying security order which would be based primarily on American power. American power in Asia, American power after 1947 in Europe, and a presence, an American overseas presence that was not going to wait, as in the 1920s and 30s, for the threats to come, but was going to, as Franklin Roosevelt said at one point in the 1930s, step on the snake before the snake bites you. So that was the order they established, and let me make one thing very clear. There were many flaws to that foreign policy. And I'm acutely aware of all the errors that that approach led to. If the previous folks had erred in leaning back, you could certainly argue that the next phase erred in leaning forward. And we had things like Vietnam, and we had the failures of Korea. We had McCarthyism, we had huge increases in defense capabilities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, leading all the way up, I'm sure many would say, to Iraq and Afghanistan. This whole policy of being proactive and leaning forward has got its downside. But I also want to say that it also has had a significant upside for all those failings. And the upside is that the human race, during this period, has enjoyed some unique sets of a unique kind of environment that has been utterly different from what has existed at any other time in human history. And that is along all three of those planes. Economically, the period after 1950 has been a period of greater economic growth than at any other time in human history, by many factors, and a growth that has been not just benefiting the Europeans or the transatlantic community, as was true of the 19th century, but which has benefited the whole world, as we see every day today in China and India and Turkey and Brazil and elsewhere. This has also been accompanied by the unprecedented growth of democracy. Democracy is a rare commodity throughout history. People have almost always lived under some form of tyranny. But in this period, we've seen democracy grow from a dozen democracies in the world to over 120 democracies in the world today. And yes, there are more nations than there used to be also. But the number of democracies is startling when you consider what has been the case throughout history. And finally, we've enjoyed a period of great power peace, which has also been a rarity in history. A peace in which none of the great powers have gone to war with one another. There have been plenty of wars, but the Cold War ended peacefully, and we've not had the kind of great power conflict which wreaks such havoc on the entire planet, as World War I did, as World War II did, as the Napoleonic Wars did in Europe and in North America. That, at least, we've managed to avoid. Any one of those things by itself would make the period special. All three of them together make the period very special indeed. And out there somewhere in the minds of academics and think tankers like myself, there is a policy that could have gotten you all that stuff without having any of the bad things. But in the real world, I haven't found it yet. I haven't seen the policy that gets you only the good things and never makes a mistake. But on balance, it's been an extraordinary period. And let me just end by saying, a world order does not sustain itself, and a world order does not last forever. We are not just witnessing, as people like Frank Fukuyama and Steven Pinker would argue, just human beings are just getting better. We're just getting nicer, and we just don't want to kill each other anymore. And what we're seeing is the gradual progression of the human race. I don't believe it for a second. What we've seen is an order that has reflected, as orders always do, the proclivities and preferences of the strongest powers or power in it. There was a Greek order, there was an Egyptian order, there was a Roman order, there was a European order, and every single one of those orders reflected the preferences of the strongest powers in them. This period of liberal order has reflected the preferences, undoubtedly, of Americans and the way they live their lives and the kind of world they want to live in. And if America ceases to continue playing the role in upholding this order that it's played these many years, the order will change. It will become a different kind of order. It will reflect someone else's preferences. And maybe we're fine with that. Personally, I'm dubious. The other possibility is that this order will descend into disorder and chaos, which is what we saw in the first half of the 20th century. I think it's quite possible, and we can argue about this, we'll talk about this in our discussion, I'm sure, for the United States to continue playing the role that it's been playing. I don't think that it doesn't have the capacity. It's really a question of whether we want to. I also think it's easier to continue upholding this order than it will be to reconstruct it once it's been destroyed. And so that's basically the philosophy that guides me. I don't know whether it's also the philosophy that guides Hillary Clinton or anybody else, but I think it's pretty much the way Americans have thought about their foreign policy going back at least to the Second World War. Whether we want to see something new, we'll have to see what our political process produces. But I'll leave it there and look forward to our conversation.
Great, thanks. Bob, so I'm somebody, and some of the students have had me in class here, and they'll know, I'm very pro-American, and I'm very pro-American primacy. And a lot of the things that I want to ask you about are because underneath it all, I'm worried that if we lean too far forward, we could easily undermine a lot of the good things that you are defending. And so let me start just simply with questions about America's power. I definitely agree. In the 1930s, this was much of the world was in a mess. And I definitely think that there is a strong connection between that and World War II. And World War II, of course, was very destructive in Europe and Asia and even in parts of the Middle East. And so there's no doubt that it made perfect sense to want an order that would avoid that chaos. But we had a major advantage at the end of World War II, which is we had nearly half, by the numbers that we can count, about 41% of the world's economic power. In one country, 41%. Everybody else, we were an 800-pound gorilla. Everybody else wasn't even barely a puppy dog. Then it falls, that ratio falls, and by the 1970s, to about 25%. So now we're a 400-pound gorilla, and the most we're facing is maybe a 100-pound Great Dane. But we're still a pretty big gorilla. That number changed after 2000. The IMF has a great database, a great website. They track America's share of economic potential compared to the world. And it goes down, starting in 2000, that is, as a consequence of much of what happened in the last decade, not the only factor, but at least partly, to today, where it's not 25% or even 20%, but 16%. Now, maybe we're still a gorilla, but we're a pretty small gorilla at this point. And we now face China, which is already nipping right at our heels. They're not quite where we are today, but they're 180. They're pretty close, and it won't be long. And one of the big things that's happened here is that we don't have as much power as we had, and yet we're using it a lot. China's not. So help me understand why, with this declining amount of power, which has certainly gone way down, and we have competitors that have come up, why we're just not making problems, our own primacy, fall faster.
I guess I'm not persuaded that the entirety of our power has really declined in the way that you talk about it. You know, the fact that our GDP was 40 or 50% of global GDP after World War II was a complete accident of history. It was because it was right after war and everybody else was flat on their backs. And it's interesting to note that the drop from that dominance to the 25% that you talk about was directly the consequence of the recovery and, in fact, the tremendous success of the economies of Germany and Japan. So if you ask me, did the drop in American GDP make it easier or harder for us to maintain the world order? I would say the net effect was to make it easier, because those two nations were allies of the United States. They were bulwarks of the security order and bulwarks of the international system that we supported, and we benefited. In fact, it was our strategy, in a way, to make them healthy in that way. So the mere drop in percentage of global GDP doesn't tell you as much as it might. A lot of the share of global GDP has been lost to China. China has a huge GDP, and I'll make an obvious point, because they have a huge population. Their per capita GDP is, I think, less than a tenth of America's per capita GDP or Europe per capita GDP. I think it's around $4,400, whereas America's per capita GDP is $44,000. I think it's right that in 1800, China's GDP was also larger than everyone else's GDP, but that didn't translate into power. So I think we need to be careful about being too monodimensional. Fundamentally, I think we are in a better strategic position than we were in throughout most of the Cold War. Let's not forget that during the Cold War, the Soviet army occupied Central Europe up through East Germany. That's no longer the case. We had to worry about China at that time. We fought wars which were debilitating in Asia, in both Korea and in Vietnam, which were much more costly and debilitating than the wars that we have fought recently, setting aside any of the wisdom of any of them. And China, which one might say is the most likely to challenge this order, I would say faces enormous difficulties in being able to do so. Difficulties which I would say they are very conscious of. Their strategic situation is very difficult. They are surrounded on all sides by major powers, most of which are feel threatened by them and seek security arrangements with the United States, going from Korea to Japan, India, some of the ASEAN countries, Australia. That's a very difficult problem that they face, because even as they rise in power, this band of nations around them, and they're no slouches themselves, Japan's military is about the third largest military in the world, get more and more nervous, and that's a real constraining factor, not to mention the obvious social problems that China faces as they move forward, the environmental problems that they face, and of course we assume a never-ending growth in the Chinese economy. So I would say, I don't know at what number of global share of GDP it's no longer possible to do that, but I don't think we've hit it yet. And so I would say our situation remains tremendously advantageous for maintaining this world order.
I told you he was smart. I want to ask some more of my worries.
Yeah.
I like allies. I'm a good realist. I want allies helping me out all the time. And I'm worried I'm going to lose a lot of allies here. So when I look out at the lean forward strategies, especially in the last 10 years, let's take Iraq as an example. That cost me half of Europe as an ally, the Iraq war. At least certainly they weren't going to help us. And when I look out at Europe, again, as we're leaning forward, even hesitantly with Obama on Ukraine, where there's Ash Carter just suddenly making a call. It's not even the president making a call for arming Ukraine. Suddenly, right away, the Germans are opposed and worried. So rather than bringing the U.S. and the Europeans together, what I'm seeing is this leaning forward is pushing them apart. Now, then I also look at Asia. And I look in the last 10 years, and yeah, Obama did a pivot to Asia, but most of us think that was pretty watered down and didn't amount to very much. And if you look at, I've been to China 8 times in the last 2 years. It's one of the things I've been expanding and developing. And as you go and talk to people, a lot of the allies there, our allies, they're actually asking us to do maybe a little bit more than we're wanting to do. Well, that's not a bad position to be in if you're sort of, again, American primacy. You know, I'm saying I'm making the case for primacy. I want the allies not running away from me. I want the allies asking for more. And so what I worry is that if we lean forward too fast, it's not that I'm saying we never do, but if we lean forward too fast, don't we really run the risk of losing more allies than we're going to gain?
Well, I think the better way of putting it is if we do things that are failures and disasters, it does put a crimp in alliance relationships. So, you know, I think that's the bigger point. The leaning forward or leaning backward question is more complicated. Mm. If you go to travel around the Middle East right now, if you meet with Saudis, if you meet with Emiratis, if you meet with Jordanians, if you meet with Lebanese, what you will hear is, we'd like you to lean a little bit more forward. They are upset about the withdrawal of American power. By the way, I'm not sure I want to lean more forward there or not, but the simple fact is they're asking for more. Anyone who speaks about Europe, and I know this from experience having lived in Europe for 6 years, and only talks about a thing called Europe, is obviously missing part of the story. What you say may be true about Germany, little less true about France, definitely true about Belgium and Spain. Not at all true about Eastern Europe. Go to the Balts. Go to Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia. Go to Poland. Go to Bulgaria. Go to Romania. They are not looking for less America. They're looking for more America. Insofar as they get alienated, it's usually because we're not giving them as much as they want. So you don't have to worry about that. Germany is a special nation. I don't have to begin to talk about the complexity of the German psychology when it comes to things like power and the use of force. It is a very difficult issue for them, and always has been. And I don't have to tell you, of course, that during the Cold War, you want to talk about restless allies. We had restless allies in Europe during the Cold War. France left NATO. Germany pursued an Ostpolitik, which was almost designed to be a counterbalance to American policy. There's nothing really new about that. But if you had to say in a general sense today, and I've actually done some surveys on this through the World Economic Forum, if you go around the world, including Latin America for that matter, they don't want military forces. They want different things in different places. The general sense you get in most of the world is they want more America today, not less. I would say they are past Iraq more than we are past Iraq. Because why? Every country is always the same. You would, I'm sure, be the first to say this was true. They just want to know what you've done for them lately. And they want to know what you're going to do for them right now. And this is the sort of odd position the United States enjoys as a result of its geography, if for no other reason. Everybody has a neighbor who's scarier to them than the United States is. Mm. So if you're in the Middle East, they're scared of Iran. If you're in Eastern Europe, they're scared of Russia. If you're in Asia, East Asia, they're worried about China. And there happens to be this big superpower across the ocean who's willing to provide some support. And that's what they want. It's not about love. It's not about affection. Do they think we're smart? They know we're not smart. They don't really love us. But they have the need. And what these relationships are ultimately built on, interests and needs.
So I'm going to go through the things I keep loving. Okay. One of the things I really love is democracy.
And these loves seem complicated. Yep. I have to say.
Actually, love is sort of like that.
Love is complicated. Love hurts. I know.
Love hurts.
Or it stinks. I can't remember what it is.
And ironically, we teach in a thing called the Common Core here at Chicago.
Oh,
kind of
yeah.
a great books, and I'm teaching Tocqueville. And Tocqueville, of course, is French, which, of course, is really ironic because today, you know, there's an issue of do the French like Americans? Well, Tocqueville definitely likes Americans. It's a very pro-American book written by a Frenchman. And he's explaining something that makes me worried about the effort to build democracy, and especially quickly and especially imposed with military power. Which is, Tocqueville really lays out that one of the big advantages for the United States is we started equal. We start equal. Now, that's not equal in the North and the South. He hates the South, so he knows the South is not equal. But in the North, the Europeans are coming, and there is a tremendous amount of equality with those Europeans who have come. Not so in the Old World, Europe. And the problem in Europe is you have hierarchies that have to then equalize over time, and he thinks many generations. Well, many of the places that we think about truly bringing democracy to are much like what Tocqueville talks about as the old world. Worlds where they are dealing with fundamental hierarchy that they have been, you know, maybe ameliorated a little bit in recent years. But take Ukraine, for instance. Ukraine's been living under a lot of hierarchy over the last 70 years. Under Soviets, okay? I mean, it's living with hierarchy. And fundamentally, Bob, isn't the problem with trying to spread democracy too quickly, and especially using military force to try to accelerate this process, just missing that collapsing those hierarchies is just going to create an enormous amount of problem? And isn't it, I too want to spread democracy, but isn't it going to be the case that this is just should be happening more on their own, evolving on their own, and maybe we can help a little bit on the edges with economic issues? But fundamentally, this is going to take many generations, and if we try to hurry it up and collapse those hierarchies fast, aren't we just going to create an enormous problem?
Well, first of all, let me just say, I'm not in favor of using military force to impose democracy. I know that's what everybody thinks Iraq was about. It wasn't. Democratization of Iraq was an ex post facto justification. Whether you like Iraq or you didn't like Iraq, that was not the reason that people went into Iraq, okay? It was to find the non-existent weapons of mass destruction because they thought Saddam Hussein was a very scary guy. And he was a very scary guy. Now, so let's be clear about that. No one is imposing democracy militarily. And, you know, what we did in Japan and Germany, again, was not let's go occupy Japan and Germany and make them because we want to make them democracies. It was just once we were there that That's kind of what America tries to do once they're already in a place. On Ukraine, I have to tell you, I think that Ukraine has gone through an amazing period of evolution in that regard. I would say their problem has not been hierarchy, it's been corruption. By the way, communism was supposed to get rid of hierarchies. It's not like you have an aristocratic class of noblemen in Ukraine. What you have was a communist hierarchy, but the biggest problem in Ukraine has been corruption. And I would say one thing that if we all want to thank Vladimir Putin for something, he has given Ukraine the best shot, as long as he doesn't invade and conquer the whole thing, of actually overcoming many of their problems that they've been able to do before as a result of the intense patriotism and nationalism in a good sense that has been instilled as a result of the Russian actions. People who know a lot more about Ukraine than I do say the current leadership in Ukraine is probably the best leadership Ukraine has had ever. Now, that's low standards, but they really are good, and they are taking a real stab at fighting corruption. So don't rule Ukraine out. It seems to me you could easily have said the same thing about Poland. You could easily have said the same thing about the Czech Republic. They also lived under communism for many decades. I am always wary when people say, this place is not right for democracy. I think we should all be humble enough to know that, A, yes, we can't impose democracy everywhere. Democracy is not going to grow everywhere. But B, we don't really know. Mm-hmm. You would never have picked a country of the per capita GDP of India and said, boy, now there's a place for democracy. There were many, many decades when Confucian societies were thought to be incapable of sustaining democracy because they were Confucian hierarchical societies. But look at what's happened in Korea and Japan and Taiwan, for that matter. Really quite miraculous. There was a long time when people said Catholic countries couldn't be democracies because of, I don't know, papal authority or something like that. That was a political scientist thought that at one time. That's been proven wrong. The only place now that everybody seems to agree you can't have democracy is in the Arab world. You can't even say it about the Muslim world because, of course, Indonesia is a functioning democracy. So I would say let's not be so sure where. And as far as things taking generations, you know, the one thing that I am pretty sure about, first of all, it's very hard for the United States to say, you figure it out, because we're never neutral. Take Egypt right now. We're not neutral in Egypt. We give them $1.3 billion a year to the military. So if we are saying we don't care what's happening, you know, we're going to let you take your time, the Egyptians know what that means. We're giving them $1.3 billion. That means we support you. It's very difficult to be a great power and say, hands off, because we're always involved in some way. And my view is, insofar as we are involved, and it's not always going to be possible, yes, we should lean in the direction of pushing in that direction. By the way, I think we make a big mistake in Egypt right now, because although you could say Egypt, we need to have a stable autocratic figure right now because of everything that's going on in the region, I think that that Sisi is going to create more instability by the nature of his regime. And that's another thing we learned in the Cold War. You know, Ronald Reagan he thought Ferdinand Marcos was our best buddy in the world. He didn't care about Philippine democracy. But then they decided that Marcos was actually the problem. He was creating more insurgency by his policies. And so we pulled the rug out from under him, pulled the rug out from under the junta in Korea. Now, after the fact, everybody says, well, Korea was ripe for democracy. Let me tell you, it wasn't obviously ripe for democracy in 1980. So anyway, long answer to a question. What's your next love?
we all love our own arguments, right? And we also, what that means is we love the positives, but we sort of know where the warts are. And we kind of love them anyway. Now, offshore balancing, some of the students here know that's a policy I would advocate. You and I have debated some of that, and I know some of the warts of that. But I've also heard you talk about, even just today, even here briefly mention some of the issues you worry about will, for instance. And rather than have me push you on it, I think they enjoy hearing a little bit about how you think, where are the difficult parts of adopting the policies as you see it? Because you've talked to presidents about your policy. You talk about your policy a lot. You know better, just like I know the limits of offshore balancing better than most of the people I debate. Mm-hmm. You know better where the real difficulties are. And yet you also have ideas about trying to overcome those difficulties. Can you just help us think through this so that we get kind of the Robert Kagan, not 101, but 202?
Okay. I wish I could. There probably is no Robert Kagan 202. I'm an introductory class. Just leave it at that. That's a challenging thing to do, obviously. I'm aware, and I think I've made it clear, that I'm aware that there is such a thing as leaning forward too far. I'm aware of the pitfalls, and my only answer to that is, as I say, I don't think there is a perfect foreign policy out there which only does the right things and never does the wrong things. So you're always going to have to make one kind of mistake or the other, and you have to decide which kind of mistake is the more important. So in any case, sure. I think, for instance, after 9/11, Iraq seemed like a bigger threat than it might have seemed like before 9/11. That doesn't mean that, you know, that was necessarily worth what we ultimately went in and did. So I could see the errors of that. But more fundamentally, I recognize how incredibly difficult this whole task is. Mm. This undertaking, this burden, and you say, if my policy is accepted, but of course, the policy we're talking about is the policy we've been pursuing now since the Second World War, for the most part, it has been very difficult. And the burdens of it are not what we always talk about, the financial burden, the the cost in lives, all of which are extremely serious and important. But there's also a very difficult moral burden that we have to bear. And it's the fact that you cannot wield power in a purely moral way. It's not possible. This is the kind of thing that Niebuhr talked about so much. And I always felt that, it's funny, people who read Niebuhr apparently see what they want to see in Niebuhr, so everybody uses him for their own reasons. He was very brilliant, I guess, that way. But when I read Niebuhr, I think what he's saying is, you have to be aware that, A, you do not have a monopoly on the moral truth, B, that the wielding of power is morally compromising, inevitably, and that's without even talking about the mistakes you make, and that you need to recognize that and have a certain humility before that, but at the same time, you can't let that fact stop you from acting. Because if you have, a global responsibility, and he talked about the world responsibility the United States had, you have to accept the moral compromises of that. But that's, of course, very hard to do. Mm. And it's something we always have to wrestle with. You know, in our own democratic system, we have a way of meting out justice that separates everybody in a way, in an interesting way. So we pass laws. We have a police to enforce the law. If someone needs to be punished, we have people who punish them. If, God forbid, people are executed, we have an executioner. But he's just following the law. He's not making the decision to execute. The police are following the law. They're not making the decision. Think about what the United States is doing in the world. It's doing all of those. It's all those roles in one. It's the decider, it's the police, and it's the executioner. That's a moral burden that none of us would want as individuals, and yet that is the nature of the international system. And we're also, understandably, we're always shocked when we find out the other guy has an argument too. Mm. But the other guy always has an argument.
Yep.
And when we find out the other guy has an argument, then we go, oh my God, we're not totally right. This is part of the disillusionment after World War I. I'm going to stop in 1 second. In World War I, the propagandists, the Creel Commission and Wilson's, it was very black and white. The Germans were evil militarists, end of story. And then after the war, they found out, the Germans were taught, they didn't really know, maybe the Kaiser actually had second thoughts about going to war, and then it was like, we were lied to. The other side did have a story. And all of these make, for a people that I think is fundamentally a moral people, it makes carrying out this role very difficult.
So I'm going to ask another question, and then I'm going to open it up to you folks. But I need you to come up to the microphone. And what I'd like to do is also remind people that you spent a long time in Washington. And this kind of builds on something I said in the earlier interview. One of the things that's changed in Washington in our lifetimes is that in the 1980s, there was a lot of dynamic where people would come in and move out of Washington with the change of administrations. today, people just live in Washington. So Washington is just permanent. That's bad for the housing market, by the way. So that's why one of the reasons housing prices are so expensive. but it also has one of the effects of the permanence of Washington is people in Washington have been increasingly stovepiped into Democrats and Republicans. Yep. And in the 1980s, there was some of this, to be sure, but it is now one of the key problems that we face. And this is one of the reasons for log jams that we see in Washington, not the only one, to be sure. However, Bob, one of the things that's very striking is your call for maintaining and spreading the liberal international order is not obviously a Republican idea or obviously a Democratic idea. In fact, it emerged out of some periods of quite a bit of consensus. So what I'd like you to tell us a little bit about as you see it, or what are the advantages and then disadvantages as you see it, about for ideas you would like to see more of as in our policies, given the nature of Washington today, where Washington now is a very divided place. Your ideas are not easily stovepiped into party A versus party B. How do you see that as an advantage, but then also how is that a disadvantage in terms of consistent positive foreign policy in your own terms?
Yeah. No, it's a fascinating question, and one of the things that I definitely have noticed in the, well, I guess it's 35 years that I've been in Washington, is that is precisely this, the increasing lack of intermingling. Yeah. Across party line. And for me, as far as in the foreign policy community, I find this particularly striking because I always felt like, at least even in the 80s, which was a very tempestuous time, a lot of partisan warfare, but to some extent the foreign policy community stayed a little bit aloof from that. Mm. And, I think that was a tradition, if you think back on the early Cold War and you had Dulles and Acheson didn't come from different universes. They sort of knew who they were. And there's a new book out about the Georgetown set. And they used to all meet at, what's-his-name's house and poke each other fingers. I mean, that was doable in those days. So there is a kind of tradition in the foreign policy community of saying, yeah, they're going to have their brutal political fights, two parties. But then, at the end of the day, and I have seen less of that. By the way, people out there in the country think that's a terrible thing, that there's this foreign policy community, because this is the elites controlling everything. So we can discuss that later. But I have been trying, with some success over the past few years, to try to get to stop that kind of division between Republicans and Democrats on the foreign policy side. Because I actually think there is a tremendous, there is a broad center on foreign policy, whether it's literally the center or not, there is a broad sort of community of common views in both parties, which you will not see in the political system. I don't know whether it was a result of the Iraq War or whether it was the Clinton impeachment. I mean, I don't know who threw the first punch, and I don't care who threw the first punch, but it has been a very bad thing, in my view. And I think I think we may be on. What's going to be interesting is that I'm going to be fascinated by the 2016 foreign policy debate. Unless you get a Rand Paul running for the Republicans and whatever the equivalent of Rand Paul is on the Democratic side, and I don't even know who that is particularly, you're going to see an interesting argument between two sets of candidates who will have a hard time explaining what they disagree about.
I agree. Because I think there's structural reasons that are actually limiting our foreign policy, so that the differences here, I think they'll, I'll just say a word, variants of offshore balancing.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be hard to break out of that, and we'll talk more difference than there'll actually be difference. And even Rand Paul, you notice, is now
moving. Well, he's kind of moving toward the center. Yeah. Look, this even happened with Obama. After all, Obama's foreign policy was not 180 degrees different from what came before.
So. Absolutely. Yeah. So with that, please, let's open up. Sir.
Professor Kagan, you talked about how things in the world order can change and deteriorate quickly. It seems to me that there are two major powers opposite the United States that have the manpower, perhaps hard to say what they're really about. You may have obviously your views. China and Russia would be the main two. Right. You may have another or more that you see as a possible disruptor of world order and our interests in the world. What is, in your opinion, what is really Putin about? Mm. What is he about? Where is he going?
Great, sir.
And what is the Communist Party of China? What are their goals? What do they want? They seem like they want to make money all over the world. Is that pretty much it?
Yeah.
Perfect. Or what?
Perfect. Great question, and we can end the session with me answering it because it's not a simple answer to either of those questions. But I'll try to, as quickly as I can. Putin is playing to a sort of kind of atavistic Russian instinct, and Russia, there is this element of Russia that has always felt itself to be in a special position. It's not a country like every other country. And it's always had this complicated relationship with the West, right? It's sometimes wanting to look more like the West and integrate with the West, and sometimes sort of defiantly standing apart. Putin is definitely playing to that latter approach right now. Whether it is for domestic political reasons, some argue that it's because it's a means of him consolidating power at home with this kind of nationalist approach, or whether he really believes it, who can know? Who can get inside his head? But he is clearly trying to reestablish, he doesn't really make any bones about it, a traditional Russian sphere of influence, which unfortunately does not end at Ukraine. I mean, a traditional Russian sphere of influence includes the Baltic states. It includes at least hegemony in Eastern and Central Europe. Poland has frequently been under Russia's control. So that is a real problem for us. And I think that we have to say we are not accepting this restoration of this sphere of influence. And I think the place to stop accepting it is in Ukraine. Because if he is able to succeed in Ukraine, everybody's problem gets much worse. So I agree with you, by the way, about the two that are the biggest challenge to the order. As far as the Chinese Communists are concerned, yeah, they want to make money, but no one is ever just about making money, right? They also the Chinese also have a memory of being the dominant power in their region. And they believe that they talk about the century of humiliation, and they were preyed upon and abused and treated horribly by the colonial powers of Europe. They have a lot to be bitter about. But it is all, I would say, a lot of what motivates China today, in addition to the desire to make money, is to reestablish China's appropriate place in the international system, and particularly in East Asia. And what they've had to wrestle with is what they consider to be the anomalous but nevertheless unavoidable reality of American power in the region. They think that the American power has got to be a blip in an otherwise clean, multi-millennial situation in which China is dominant, and yet America continues not to recede. And the Chinese have had to address this, and I have to say, I've never seen a country conduct itself in the role that China is conducting itself, which is that of a rising power, with greater care, with greater precision. They sometimes make mistakes, and then they pull back. And the thing that they are, which no rising power has ever been in history, is they're self-aware. They are aware of the effect that they're having on others. And I think this is a good thing. And I think that, therefore, there is a great possibility. A country like Wilhelmine Germany, they didn't care what anybody else thought. And I think rising Japan didn't care that much about what other people thought. And God knows America, when it was rising in the 19th century, didn't care what anybody else thought. The Chinese are very aware of how people are reacting to them. But that's their goal. But how they get there is another question.
How do we stop the Russians in Ukraine?
I think I'm bound probably to go to another question.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
if I find that, I'll find an opportunity.
Yeah, we will definitely find a way to weave that in, sir. Yes, please.
Hi, Professor Kagan. Thank you for being with us tonight. You made the point that that autocracy in the Third World tends to breed instability. As dictators try to maintain their own power, that they create these problems. But it strikes me that you're also here making the case for an international order based on the dominance of a single country, the United States, based on American primacy as a means of achieving stability on an international scale. And I'm just wondering, isn't there a paradox there? And aren't we going to run into the same problem as Sisi? Aren't we going to start creating instability just by trying to maintain our own status as a world superpower? And I'm also curious on what you think we should do in Ukraine.
Okay. Thank you. I'll tell you what, if five people ask me what we should do in Ukraine, I'll answer the question. No, I'm just kidding. No. I mean, I really think that although that's an interesting analogy, the analogy, it doesn't really work. And what is the most remarkable element of American primacy, if you will, is the astonishing degree to which it has been accepted, at the very least, and in some cases welcomed by the international system. And by the way, if you want to know whether the international system is accepting American primacy, all you have to do is look at people's defense budgets. You know who's not accepting American primacy. The Chinese are not accepting it. The Russians are not accepting it. I suppose if the Iranians had any money, they would not be accepting it. But the Europeans are not saying this is an intolerable situation, because there's only one way out. If it is an intolerable situation, build enough power to be... The Europeans said they want to have a multipolar world, and I always said to the Europeans, so be a Pole! You know? We'd love you to go be a Pole! But anyway, so that's the proof. The proof is that the system that the United States sort of oversees is not so intolerable to the vast majority of nations in the world that they want to try to do anything about it. And that's not normal. As any political science and IR theorist will tell you, when a great power emerges, everybody is supposed to gang up against them. That's what has traditionally happened. It really hasn't happened. I know you've written about soft balancing. It's pretty soft, I would say.
If we have more, it depends on how aggressive we become.
Anyway, suffice to say that we've not, you know, the United States has broken this sort of iron law of international relations. And I think that's, in a way, it's a unique attribute of this international system. Should I do Ukraine now, or should I wait for five more questions?
Let's somebody else in, because they really have come to ask you.
Right.
Yes. Please, Robert.
I'll add a vote to hear about the Ukraine, but... What I wanted to ask is, American politicians are vying to run away from nation building, and you seemed very lukewarm about it a moment ago. But arguably, the rise of ISIS is due to a failure to follow through with serious nation building in Iraq. And in looking at every disaster as an opportunity, what ISIS is rampaging through now provides an occasion to actually do serious nation building, and let's add Syria and Iraq, as a thought experiment. Like, we know the political will isn't there, but supposing it were actually to do nation building in Syria and Iraq in a way that would create pluralist, even, let's say, liberal democratic states that would become allies of a liberal world order. Is there a strategy to get to that point from the mess we're in now? What would it cost, and what would be the possible benefits?
It's another great question, which I really love having to answer. By the way, if anything I said indicated that I was hostile to nation building, I take it I'm not hostile to nation building. I do think that nation building is an unavoidable element of not just America's foreign policy, but really, I would say, the liberal world is going to have to engage in that at some times. And if we haven't seen the consequences of failed states by now, I would think we should have already learned our lesson. Iraq, I believe, is actually still salvageable. And I think it was a mistake to withdraw the troops when Obama did, because it sort of let Maliki free to be the kind of Shiite dictator that he always wanted to be, and that was unfortunate. But I do think that Iraq is a place that can actually be turned into, people love to say, is it going to be a Jefferson? I don't even know what a Jeffersonian democracy is when people say that, by the way, because we never ourselves built a Jeffersonian democracy. Exactly. But in any case, it may not be everything we want it to be, but it can be a pretty reasonable society, I believe. Now, getting from Assad / ISIS / chaos to that in Syria, I don't know what the exact steps are. But they certainly begin with getting rid of Assad. And I think that really all along that should have been our goal. Assad is at least half responsible for the growth of ISIS in Syria. Every reason that people gave for why we shouldn't do something for Syria because the following terrible 17 things would happen, well, all those terrible 17 things have now happened, despite the fact that we haven't had a policy like that. But I wouldn't be so bold as to venture a strategy on how you get to liberal democracy in Syria. However, I do think the international community, and by which I mean essentially the international liberal community, is going to have to get back into the business of if not nation building, certainly nation stabilizing. It was a mistake, and the president acknowledges this himself, after the Libya intervention, not to get an international peacekeeping force into Libya to prevent it from breaking down into this chaos that's broken down. We did this repeatedly in the 1990s, with great success, I would say. If ever there was an area where people did say you couldn't possibly get all these people to stop killing each other, it was the Balkans. And yet, fundamentally, the international community did succeed in getting all those people to stop killing each other. And if it had not been for Iraq and Afghanistan and this sort of general understandable aversion to nation building that we've had, we would be in better shape in some of these places. So one of the rebalancing that I think, you know, American foreign policy is like this. The pendulum swings from one side to the other side within a narrow space, but, you know, we go from over-intervention to under-intervention. We have to find a balance somewhere, which means that we are willing to do nation building when it's plausible and when it's necessary.
Sir.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kagan. Well, as a person coming from China, tonight I've been hearing a lot about my home country. But first and foremost, I want to stress that, I can stand and I appreciate America's sense of responsibility and this generosity. And myself, in particular, being here, having the chance to study in this beautiful university would be one tiny result of that generosity and responsibility, which I forever, I have been always grateful for. But, I guess there is still some difference between occasional goodwill do-gooders and self-proclaimed word please with a formal lean forward policy, because the latter requires a tremendous amount of consistency in policy, which I suspect sometimes it's not easy for America to afford that. One example would be, let's come back to China, not Ukraine, but China, the rise of China. You've talked about the rise of China a lot. But let's not forget that the rise of China was by and large, made by America. Let's put it in that way. And made by America, despite the fact that sometimes America is making the rise of China when she is behaving against her nominal core values. Well, one example is the first love letter Deng Xiaoping received after Tiananmen massacre was from President George H.W. Bush, assuring him, although you have blood in your hand, let's be friends and do business and making money together. I mean, so for me, it raises some sense of cynicism. So I definitely appreciate there would be a powerful country to promote, you know, prosperity and freedom, liberty. But now America is like, we are, don't worry, we're promoting the democracy and prosperity and freedom, except when we are not.
No.
And you don't know when we are and when we are not.
No.
So, is it possible that America could go back to that occasional do-gooder, goodwill do-gooder, instead of having this formal lean forward policy, which will again require a tremendous amount of responsibility, I guess would potentially backfire American own national interests.
Yep.
And thank you.
Thank you. That's a great question. And of course, I don't think I sat up here and said that America has always been promoting democracy, because of course that's not true. America has been hypocritical. It has been self-interested, and as you correctly say, it has been inconsistent and lacking in a certain kind of long-term commitment to anything. I mean, the only way you can get Americans to do something for 50 years is by not telling them that they're going to do it for 50 years. I mean, if you had told Americans that they were going to put 30,000 troops in Korea and they would be there for the next 60 years, they would have said, are you out of your mind? There's no way we're going to do that. So, you know, Americans, America is have a very ambivalent attitude toward the world. I think we know that. By the way, this is a virtue, too, because the world kind of knows that America is ambivalent. Therefore, we don't look like as much of a monster as we might look like if we really had a plan. I mean, there's nothing scarier than a big power with a plan, right? Everybody knows that that's not the problem with the United States. Now, you know, America's policy toward China has been wonderfully paradoxical, but very consistent, actually, in the sense that regardless of George Bush's love letter, American policy has been to contain China and to try to get rich in China at the same time, right? Sometimes America has also tried to press for human rights improvement in China, but mostly we sold ourselves a bill of goods, which was very satisfying, which is that the way we can liberate China is by making money in China. So we had the whole, you know, economic engagement will bring change to China. Well, now we're kind of up against the fact that that hasn't really happened, although a lot of people still tell themselves that it's going to happen. So I'm with you, and it certainly puts a lie to the notion that America is just constantly going around trying to liberalize every country in the world, because that hasn't been the case in China. Now, but at the same time, and I just want to say something about the rise of China. I am for the rise of China. I am for the economic growth of China. I am for the uplifting of the poor in China. I am for China's success. And the only thing that I am not in favor of is the military expansion of China's hegemony in East Asia. That's the only part of the rise that I don't want. And since China claims that it has no interest in doing that, we're in perfect agreement.
Great. Yes. And only 1 minute. So now I'm going to start watching the clock. So just 1 minute.
All right. Thank you. Since I think it's a generally common theme throughout all this that we like to avoid a drastic change in the world order, I just want to ask this. When we do find ourselves in the case where the reins are sort of slipping out of our fingers, to who or to what should we quickly hand the reins over to?
Good.
That's good. That was much less than a minute, and the answer is there's no one to hand it over to.
Good on both parts. That was good.
So I have a minute and a half, right?
Smart. Smart audience. Too.
What I wanted to ask is, an Israeli studying IR here, it's a great department here, but I have to answer to a lot of Mearsheimerists here who claim that...
Well, at least no one can accuse you of dual loyalty.
That's true. Who claim that, you know what they claim, people like you and Israel is not an asset, but what's the opposite?
Liability.
Yes.
Right.
And that America should... stop supporting it because it's pissing off the Arab world. What would you advise me to answer to fellow students and to Mearsheimer that say that on moral grounds and on interest?
Well, I mean, you shouldn't answer, you know, because it's not for, honestly, it's not for an Israeli to explain to Americans what Americans' interests are, you know, and I think that's really my problem, and you know, it's Americans' problem. And I have to say, although I'm a great supporter of Israel because it's a democracy, because it's an ally, I myself insist that when America makes decisions, it has to make decisions based on American interests. So, for instance, I disagree with Israel's policy toward Egypt, because Israel has been one of the great supporters of Sisi and spends a lot of time influencing the American Congress also to support Sisi, and I just think that happens to be wrong. And I think that the relationship is healthier to the degree to which we understand that we are two separate countries. Then what I say is, I feel about Israel the way I feel about England, the way I feel about Taiwan, the way I feel about France, These are democratic countries, in some cases democratic countries under siege, countries for which the United States has accepted and bears responsibility for defending. And this is not because, if I may say so, because the Jews run everything in America. This was a decision made by Harry Truman, probably for reasons of Protestant evangelical reasons. But in any case, it's a widely supported view in American foreign policy, just as all kinds of other countries that we support are. And I have yet to see, other than, the major problems we face in the Middle East today have almost nothing to do with how the Arabs feel about Israel. What ISIS is seeking, what Al-Qaeda is seeking, is for the West to get out of their realm. Out the West. And unfortunately, you have to decide what their realm is. I don't know whether it includes Andalusia. I don't know how far it goes up in the Balkans. But in any case, Israel is just a symptom of the fact that the West has prevented them from returning to the 7th century where they would like to live again. And to lay that all on Israel is a tremendous injustice, it seems to me. I don't know if that helps or not, but that's my best answer.
That's good. Please, sir.
You spoke about earlier how after World War II, the United States had like roughly 44% of world GDP. And then when it declined to 25%, the remainder of that went primarily to our allies, like Germany, Japan. Yeah. But a lot of people are arguing like in the 21st century, the major rising countries are going to be, say, BRICS, to put one label on it.
Yeah.
And take China and Russia. Both of them are massively increasing their military spending, Russia 33% this last year. And if they're economic, and like I guess Kissinger makes the argument that the world's going to be multipolar in the 21st century, and that and we're seeing this, I guess we're seeing economic growth spread out from not just our allies to the rest of the world with opposing viewpoints. And I guess how do you think the United States should respond to the growth of both their military and economic clout?
I gotcha. It's a good question. By the way, Kissinger has been predicting a return to the multipolar world for over 50 years. I just want to make that clear, because it's the world that he loves. If you go back and read A World Restored, you'll see what the love is all about, because then he can be Metternich. But in any case, never mind. I would say, first of all, again, the BRICS, no one even talks about the BRICS in a serious way anymore, because Russia is not a growing economy now, and it's not just because of the sanctions. Russia's position in the BRICS was based entirely on the high price of oil. Putin did nothing during all that period to diversify the Russian economy, and now oil is tanked, and there so far has the Russian economy. So when I hear people talk about Russia, they talk about a declining power. Now, my argument is Russia's been declining for 400 years, so I don't know what that means. But nevertheless, you can't talk about them in a serious way anymore. China's growth has slowed, but I take seriously China. Now, but India, see, I put in the same class as Germany and Japan. Is it a net negative for the United States if India becomes both economically and militarily stronger, or is it a net positive? It seems to me clear it's a net positive. Because even though there's nothing more complicated and painful than having a relationship with India, nevertheless, as several presidents have discovered, by the way, they feel the same way about us, so it's fine. Nevertheless, objectively speaking, India is strategically concerned about China and therefore shares American strategic concerns, whether we're allies or not. So India, I'm not troubled by. I think it's beneficial. Is it bad for us that Brazil is growing? Does that take away from American power? By the way, even if Brazil is also slowed? I don't think so. So a lot of this rise of the rest that Fareed Zakaria talked about, I don't care if somebody has the higher Ferris wheel in another country, you know, which is where he leads that book. By the way, the pie's Ferris wheel is now in America again, so that changes everything. To me, the question is not whether other powers are rising. To me, the question is, what effect does it have on the liberal world order that the United States supports? Is it a net positive or a net negative? Most of this other growth is a net positive for the United States. And the only one that potentially presents a real problem is China. And yet, I think it is a problem that can, in fact, be managed if we are intelligent.
Yes.
What role do you think institutions play, like the UN, the IMF, the World Bank? And do you think that they have power and influence today? Do you think that that power and influence should increase? And do you think it can?
Very good question also. The UN, other than, you know, the UN has agencies which do a lot of wonderful things around the world. And so I'm not talking about the UN agencies when I answer the question. I'm talking about the UN Security Council. The UN Security Council has had this very wonderful history. It was born and then immediately went into a coma because of the Cold War, and then you had the U.S. and the Soviets on opposite sides, and you couldn't do anything at the UN Security Council. Then there was this brief moment of awakening as the Soviet Union began to collapse, and you had the first Gulf War where the Soviets voted with the United States. And so we had this moment when we thought, oh my God, we're back to a world where the UN and Security Council is actually going to be able to function. And I don't know whether people have seen the movie Awakenings. Have you seen it? It's a bunch of people in a coma, and then the guy gives, Robin Williams gives them a special drug or something, and they all come out of their comas, and at the end of the movie, they all go back into their comas again. And that's kind of, to me, what's happened with the UN Security Council, is that we are back to a divided UN Security Council, which on the big issues, which is the use of force, the use of sanctions, are rarely going to agree. So I don't, you know, I don't have much hope for that. The IMF, I don't know what to say about the IMF, except that the Congress has made a very big mistake in blocking the expansion of shares of voting rights for China and India and other countries. That's very short-sighted on our part. The cost to us in terms of our net influence is very small, and it has sent a signal to the rest of the world that we just refuse to accept reality. And as it hastened the Chinese effort to create, you know, to support things like the BRICS Bank and the Asian infrastructure, what is that thing called? The investment bank, right? Yeah. And with those things which may or may not work, but they're the consequence of a very short-sighted attitude. By the way, on the UN Security Council, I believe we should expand the UN Security Council membership to include, you know, India and Brazil and other countries. I don't see any reason not to do that, but obviously that's not going to happen. So these institutions do need to be reformed if they're going to stay relevant, put it that way.
Professor Kagan, you ended your beginning talk with a fairly strong causal statement about the relationship between U.S. power and the liberal economic, social, what have you, institutions. What are the primary mechanisms by which you see those being sustained by U.S. power?
Well, you know, I think it's complicated. In some cases, it's complicated. In some cases, it's not. In the case of the liberal economic order depends on the most important economies wanting to have a liberal economic order. And by the way, historically, there's only been two nations that wanted to have a liberal free trading economic order. One was Britain, and one was the United States. And it has to do with the fact that Britain was an actual island, America was kind of an island, they were, and the nature of their political systems at home, they benefited more than anybody else from such a system. Continental powers have never wanted an open free trading system. They want closed systems that they can control, like Napoleon's system, like Hitler's system, like the Soviet system. So it's partly you can't expect other countries necessarily to support a liberal economic order if it's not to their advantage to do so. So thus the fact that the United States is still strong enough to do that, the leading power, that's one reason why you still have a liberal economic order. It's not the only reason, but that's a major factor. And secondly, the underlying security order has to make a liberal economic order possible, because if you're constantly at war, then you have a breakdown of a liberal economic order by necessity. And so the fact that we've been able to maintain a great power peace, the fact that the United States Navy plays the role that the British Navy played of keeping the waterways open, of even in times of war, unlike the British, actually, the United States does not close international waterways. So that's clearly a vital role. On democracy, it's a closer call because I think it's a less direct causal, although some of it is causal. The world tends to follow the winner. You know, when the fascists looked like they were on the march, you had all these little fascist countries popping up all over the world. When the Soviet Union looked like it was done, you had more communist countries. And since the democracies looked like they were winning, you have more democracies.
So I want you, the next two, I'm going to let you both ask a question briefly, but right in order. And then, Bob, I'd like you to take
okay. Do I need to do Ukraine?
Well, we're going to give you the final word, okay. No matter what. So right. both of you ask short questions.
Okay, thank you. Just a quick, very quick question. What is your understanding of order and disorder? If a rising power is challenging the local order, do you consider it as a disorder or a new form of order? Okay, thank you.
Okay, and sir?
This is kind of related to the question that was already asked, but like, although Israel has shared values with the United States, other than shared values, do you think it's strategic security value can stand alone in terms of U.S. support for Israel, or is it mainly because of values that we provide aid and weapons and such?
Are you saying, is Israel a security asset for the United States?
Can Israel
survive alone without United States support?
I'm saying that, like you mentioned in his answer, that a major reason is values. And I'm saying, like, because there are other democracies in the Middle East, and Israel differs in
Not
ways.
Not too many.
Israel differs in some ways from our values, in that they don't have a constitution and the continuous building of the settlements.
Well, the British don't have a constitution either. They're still buddies.
And then that they're like in a liberal democracy, and that not everyone has equal rights.
Yeah, I don't accept that either. But anyway, I think the key thing, I do think it's values. I do think it's a sense of responsibility and a correct sense of responsibility given the United States' role in Israel's creation. And in no way would the United States be benefited by abandoning Israel, put it that way. The negative effect of that would be very great, because everyone knows what a close ally Israel is. But I have a hard time distinguishing my commitment to that than to my commitment, as I say, to Great Britain. So I'm going to move on to the other question, okay? Otherwise,
so
we're going to...
So you think it's overall well, strategic...
Yep. No, I think we're going to have to...
I think I've answered it pretty...
Unfortunately, there's...
Pretty confusingly. Disrupting the local order, I mean, if you're talking about the order within Asia, that's a local order, but I think it has global implications. So if you, there are regions of the world that are more important than other regions. If you change the order in Europe, that has global implications. If you change the order in Asia, that has global implications. I don't even know, it's hard for me to say there is an order in the Middle East, so I don't know what you would be changing it to or from. But I think that, for me, the question is, it's really at the larger level that these things matter. And, you know, we have two geographic areas that have been the key, two and a half. And as I said to a previous group, until the continents shift again, this is the geographical configuration that we live with. This is where the populations are. This is where the money is. This is where the power is. And that's why this is what determines the direction of the globe. So I would leave it there. And I'll tell you what, afterwards I'll try to do Ukraine if you want.
Well, why don't you say a word on
Ukraine? All right, let me say about it. Okay, I thought you were trying to say shut up.
No, I just trying to one get Ukraine on the table.
There's two questions with Ukraine, and you know, you don't know what the answer to one of them, to either of them is. I suspect that Putin is sorely tempted to just say, to hell with everybody, I win, send in the troops and take, and he's just looking for the excuse. Another part of him may know that that could be a complete disaster for him. And even if, in pure military terms, Russian superiority over Ukraine is unquestioned, they still have a country of 40 million people who I think might at very least go into a guerrilla conflict and make it very painful for the Russians. In my view, we ought to make it as painful for them as possible. And therefore, if we can provide anti-tank weapons, that makes you less willing to use tanks. And the other thing I'm confident of is that Putin is extremely sensitive about body bags going home to Russia. We've already seen that. They lost several hundred fighters They packed them in, the corpses into unmarked trucks. They drove them in the middle of the night, and not to their homes, but to other places where the mothers and parents had to come. When the mothers started protesting, they suppressed the protests and they took them off the internet. When the soldiers were Facebooking, I don't know where I am, but I think I'm in Ukraine, they shut down their Facebook. Okay, they have the experience of the Afghansi, and I think that Putin is nervous about all that. He would like to, what his goal in Ukraine ultimately is to keep that government destabilized, broke, and he's playing a long game, and he ultimately hopes that he can regain the control that he once had. I don't think he's itching to invade. Therefore, all of this, we can't send them lethal weapons because he's going to invade. I think, you know, I think that's not a likely option. And we are being bluffed into feeling that, you know, this whole argument that he wants it more than they do, you know, more than we do, and therefore we have to give in. Boy, that argument will take you a long way. There's a lot of things that other people want more than we do. I don't know where you would stop with that. You certainly wouldn't. Do we want Estonia more than he does? I don't know. So I think that we are being a little bit psychologically bamboozled by Putin in this case. But if you asked me at the end of the day, I would say, so move a NATO division forward if that's what it takes. Does he want to have a war with NATO? You know? A guy has escalation dominance only if you say you have escalation dominance. You don't have to give in to that. However, I think that that's not necessary. I think that we can keep him at bay, and he's going to look for a solution which keeps the fire burning in Ukraine, but is not an all-in. And in response to those who think that we have no interest in Ukraine, I just think that's a big mistake. I think that giving in to the idea that Russia has a special privileged sphere of influence in a country that it recognizes as independent, you know, and it at its birth recognized as independent, it is a mistake for us to succumb to that.
That's an excellent point. I want to say a word before we stop. We're going to have to stop about the importance of ideas. What you just heard Bob do was lay out an argument with ideas. And let me just roll back. Many people want to know, how did we get into Iraq? How did we get into Iraq? And I know we could talk about a lot of the details and so forth. But 12 years ago, January 2002, just shortly thereafter, I was running one of our workshops, and I decided to do something very different. I brought Jim Woolsey and Richard Pearl, two leading intellectuals from Washington, to come to give major public talks on their argument why we should go into Iraq. And what they did each, and they basically gave the same talk, Bob. It was actually kind of stunning. They each gave a 45...
They all had the script coming in.
Well, they were the people who wrote the script. They laid out a 45-minute argument for why we had to go in to confront Islamic radicalism by democratizing the Middle East, and Iraq was the place to begin. That was an idea. Now, maybe your other factors matter, too. I don't mean to tell you ideas run the world wholly on their own. But that idea was powerful and moved people. It's terribly important, folks, for us to engage with ideas that really are moving the world. And whether you want to go in Ukraine or not and follow Bob's plan, okay, just know that you are hearing the powerful case for pushing the liberal order forward. And that powerful case, I can't tell you that you're going to have a president necessarily just pick it right up like we saw with Pearl and Woolsey, but we are really talking about ideas that are moving the world, and it's important for us to think about them deeply. And Bob, thank you for helping us do that.
Well, thank you.
Incredibly powerful. Incredibly powerful. Thank you. And I wish we could actually go on and on, but we've got to take you to another event.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you all for coming.